Arsenal for Democracy is freely available weekly at arsenalfordemocracy.com or Apple and Stitcher, and we're supported by some listeners at patreon.com/arsenalfordemocracy for $3 a month. The show is recorded and produced by me, Bill Humphrey, in Newton, Massachusetts. Our theme music is produced by Stuntbird. Follow us on Facebook or at AFD Radio on Twitter. The show is not affiliated with any campaign committee, and each participant's opinions are their own.
This land is your land. This land is my land. California, New York Island, the Redwood Forest, Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy, episode 397, recorded on Sunday, September 26th, 2021. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me on the line from Idaho, as always, is Rachel. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, Bill.
And joining us again on the line from New York is Kelly. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, Bill. Hi, Rachel.
Arsenal for Democracy this week continues our mini-series on money in the 19th century United States. What was it? Was it something physical with a real value or more of an abstraction? How did people understand it at the time versus how we understand money today? What were the economic, political, and socio-cultural implications of the 19th century version of American money? In parts 1 and 2 of this series, we looked at currency and forms of paper money in the antebellum Civil War and Reconstruction period, and we emphasized the chronic shortages of money in circulation within the United States, particularly in rural areas. In part 3 today, we want to talk about the situation after the end of Reconstruction as the money circulation tightened again, and we want to examine the coping mechanisms people used during this period, both in rural areas and in the growing industrial cities. In both places, to a greater or lesser degree, money ended up existing as kind of a unit of account on a ledger somewhere more than any physical object or paper in circulation. This was most true in the rural areas, especially in the West, with institutions like the general store selling on credit between harvests and eventually payment plans for farm equipment. But this version of money, experienced primarily as a unit of account, was also the case in some urban contexts, such as door-to-door peddlers offering payment plans, which we first discussed on our episode about Singer sewing machines. However, many urban workers found that they were not given the same opportunities for delaying or spreading out payments for purchases as the farmers were, even while they themselves were paid intermittently and unreliably. And so they often needed to be able to access physical money more quickly. This led to the shadowy world of gray market and black market lending institutions and high-interest loan sharks that were the forerunners of today's payday loans and pawn shops, still serving a similar niche. Now, as a side note here, listeners might also be wondering at this point about other unsavory forms of compensation, credit, and exchange in this period, such as company scrip or Southern sharecropping credit. But I decided that we're not actually going to get into that here or in this series in general, because I would argue that those both functioned almost explicitly as a method of enslaving people without legally being considered slavery. So these forms of payment were really intended to be so narrowly useful to the recipients that they don't really qualify as genuine expressions of financial credit or as money circulation substitutes, like we had talked about with the antebellum banknotes. So basically, they're just a different type of thing and not really comparable to any of the other forms of money that we're talking about. While a shady urban lender might be effectively chaining the borrower to a job and a paycheck, this was not slavery in the way that company stores and sharecropping were, and there was actual real cash involved in those urban lending transactions. These institutions were there to make a profit by filling a need, not to just avoid spending money on labor, which is essentially what company scrip and with at company stores, as well as the similar practice of sharecropping credit were. So this week, we will be talking about frontier store credit, early payment plans, shadow credit markets in American cities, and things like that. We'll be drawing most heavily this episode from the book Financing the American Dream, A Cultural History of Consumer Credit by Lendahl Calder, published in 1999, and we'll circle back to that later in the series as well, but that's going to be the basis for most of today's episode. Later in the series, we'll talk about the political battles that arose in the post-Reconstruction period over U.S. monetary policy, such as William Jennings Bryan and the Cross of Gold, and then we'll return to the question of credit for ordinary people with the transformation from simple store credit, early installment plans, small dollar lenders and pawn shops to more sophisticated so-called consumer credit finance plans that evolved into the 20th century U.S. economy of home mortgages, auto loans, credit cards, and things like that. By the 1920s, consumer credit alone was already a multi-billion dollar industry, and home mortgages had been well into the trillions since the 1890s when estimates began to be compiled. But the seeds of that transformation were planted and starting to grow quietly in the era and institutions we're talking about this week, which would be like basically the 1870s, especially the later end of the 1870s, the 1880s, and then a little bit into the 1890s. Those later developments in the 20th century were only possible with a cultural shift in how people understood money, their uses for it, and the appropriateness of borrowing. And that's something that we'll definitely be returning to later in the series as well when we get more specifically focused on the cultural elements of this. As usual, the notes for this episode will be available at arsenalfordemocracy.com in a PDF. And with that, let's get into it. So I want to briefly recap the themes from last week's episode, parts one and two, that will be relevant to today. And to do that, there's actually two pages from the Calder book from 1999 that we didn't include in the notes last week, but they basically cover the same thing and just very conveniently sort of summarize it so that you understand the foundations of the period that we're talking about and what had come before. So the author writes, "Money, once something that could be melted down and weighed, was transformed to a higher level of abstraction. Once real enough that it could be bitten and tasted, money became a hidden reality only represented by a banknote or certificate of deposit. Abstraction made for confusion. Inexplicable expansions and contractions of the money supply led the New York Evening Post in 1836 to label money the invisible hand. There seemed to be no accounting for its capricious movements. The political economist H.C. Carey reported in 1840 that money was so much mystified it is generally deemed incomprehensible, and the consequence is that few persons attempt to understand it. Paper money may have seemed invisible in its inner workings, but not in its physicality, which was visible enough. Before the Civil War, most paper money was issued by private banks. By 1850, so many types of banknotes circulated that only an expert with the aid of a catalog could set values on out-of-town notes. Even bankers found the money supply perplexing. An Indiana banker named Calvin Fletcher complained in his diary how much difficulty and trouble it was to effect between exchanges between various out-of-state banknotes and U.S. Treasury notes. He wished that paper currency could be abolished. When bank money was short, local money was devised to remedy the inconvenience of barter. Local money, warehouse receipts, company orders on local merchants, lottery tickets, private tokens, merchants' due bills, private banknotes, sometimes formed the exclusive medium of exchange in a locale without sanction of law. Confusion and bad money reigned. For this reason, most people moved back and forth between barter, credit, and money economies, participating in the latter only when they had reliable paper money or coins. After 1863 and the creation of a system of nationally chartered banks, paper money stabilized because it was de facto guaranteed by the national government. But there remained in circulation a kaleidoscopic variety of monetary forms. Between 1860 and 1890, five different types of specie circulated, and 11 different types of paper currency, including greenbacks and yellowbacks, silver certificates, and private paper money. The North American Review voiced a common complaint when it observed, "The rebellion has left us with an excessively complicated currency." The baffling nature of money in 19th century America helps explain why people then, as never before and never since, made such great efforts to master the meaning of money. But there is more to the explanation. The paradox of an expanding money economy is that even while money increases quantitatively, from the point of view of wage earners, money always seems scarce. Thus, another reason Americans in this era talked a lot about money and credit was because they lived in a world increasingly dominated by the abstraction of money, but short, for some very short, on its concrete supply. But the American passion for money was stimulated most of all by the symbolic uses of money in American society. Money was imperialistic, it could not be limited to economic life, but as Alexis de Tocqueville had observed, expanded its reach until it was found at the bottom of everything in America. Money, of course, has never been merely a medium of exchange, but de Tocqueville correctly perceived that in a democratic society without fixed social ranks, and it could be added an advanced money economy where impersonal exchange was replacing personal ties, the uses of money multiplied prolifically. William Makepeace Thayer, a popular expositor of the Victorian money ethic, made the point explicit. Money is bread, money is raiment, money is shelter. More than that, money is education, refinement, books, pictures, music. Money is the society of the learned and accomplished. Instantly convertible for any good or service, money in the late 19th century became a prime symbol of wealth. Money was also American society's equivalent of the law of gravity. It held everything together in relations of value. Money in the United States brought some people together and separated others. It replaced rank as a key determinant of social position. It was a means to social mobility. So I wanted to read that passage because I felt like it sets the stage really well for this transitional period. We're not into the full-blown consumer economy that we're going to see in the turn of the century and early 20th century and certainly the rest of the 20th century, but we're also leaving the era behind that had existed before the Civil War. As the Second Industrial Revolution took off, there were quickly lots more things for consumers to buy, but not necessarily the money in circulation or on hand with which to buy it. So how did they buy things? Rachel, we're going to go to you now to talk about peddler installment plans and retail installments, which became one of those methods. And then we'll talk to Kelly about farm equipment and the rural dimension of these elements.
Peddlers were middlemen hired by retailers to bring in immigrant consumers and introduce them to American consumption. This was kind of a win-win situation because the peddlers were given retail experience that could lead to jobs in store, and then the stores had access to a new demographic. Peddlers used their connection to immigrant communities to build relationships between consumers and the stores. They literally brought customers into to department stores and helped them navigate the confusing world of American consumerism. They helped with language barriers and matters of American purchasing etiquette. So this turned a formerly fraught experience on the part of the immigrant consumers into a positive one and created loyal customers. Peddlers would also go door-to-door to sell goods on installment plans and then visit consumers' homes to collect the payments. And over time, the peddlers became trusted family friends. One example from the Calder book tells the story of a peddler who sold a sewing machine to a family, and he came to the family's house every week for 25-cent payments over a period of 18 years, really building that relationship with the family. So once department stores saw how successful this peddler installment scheme was, they started offering installment plans in store. Stores quickly adopted this scheme, and a new form of store appeared, which aggressively sold low-quality, overpriced goods to low- and middle-income households on installment, really saturating the market, reaching these low- and middle-income households, and offering them goods that previously were unavailable to them. These stores were called Borax stores in that they, quote, cleaned a person out. These stores selling cheap, shoddy goods kind of hurt the credibility of installment buying among middle-income consumers. These Borax stores were primarily furniture and clothing stores. We've talked before about how clothing wasn't really available to low-income consumers. They made their own clothes, or and they had two sets of clothes, their Sunday best and their weekday clothes. For example, in 1899 Boston, half of the city's furniture stores sold mainly on installment. So it really exploded in the latter half of the 19th century and just filled the market with goods that were previously unavailable to low and middle income families. Although there were some of these less than credible retailers aggressively marketing to families without much money, these low-income families were able to afford goods that were previously unavailable to them. So items such as pianos and other musical instruments were now attainable, and these households were able to own a piece of culture. I see it as a net good, even though there were some of these kind of predatory department stores reaching out to these consumers. So where did this kind of installment credit scheme come from? So installment credit, including the rent-to-own model, became popular in the late 18th century. Calder tells the tale of a countess who wanted to outfit her house in the Parisian fashion with fancy furniture sets. The countess included in the payment agreement that she wanted to retain the option to buy the furniture, and she told all her friends to outfit their houses in this manner. So it kind of created a popular fancy sheen on this installment credit scheme, which previously was mainly relegated to like the peasant classes prior to this time. Installment credit exploded in the mid 19th century with the rise of machines, such as household appliances, such as sewing machines and record players, which we've talked about in previous episodes, and farm equipment, which we will talk about shortly. While these household appliances and equipment made life and work significantly easier, they were also a significant expense for workers. So significant, in fact, that many workers were hesitant to buy them, even with traditional credit instruments. And installment credit helped to overcome that hesitancy. You're kind of trading on your future income to get a good now, which was pretty attractive to buyers. So, Kelly, do you want to talk about the farm equipment aspect?
Absolutely. So in more rural areas, at the beginning of the 19th century, farmers actually owned very few things. There had been few technological advancements since biblical times as far as agriculture goes. So farmers lived pretty simply. I'm almost imagining they like inherit these farm tools from their family. They have a few pieces of furniture, some clothes, like Rachel said, their Sunday best and weekday work clothes, but they didn't have a lot of stuff. However, as more efficient farm equipment was developed throughout the 19th century, producers needed a way to make this farm equipment affordable to farmers. The equipment was often so expensive that it couldn't even be paid off in a single season, and more long-term plans were necessary. For example, McCormick is one of the companies responsible for these farm equipment payment installments. And a McCormick Reaper was about $100 at a time when the annual income for a farmer was only about $300. So you imagine they have home expenses, they're feeding children, they have many expenses, but a third of their annual income would be needed to buy this Reaper. So what McCormick did was introduce the installment plan with a small down payment up front and the balance due after the crop. McCormick quickly found that this payment plan put a drain on his own finances. So he went on to introduce a generous discount for upfront payment, but still 2/3 of purchasers still preferred to buy using the payment plan. And I think this shows just how great the need was for these sorts of payment plans, as we still see in, you know, credit today. If you buy anything up front, it's cheaper, but people still defer to payment plans because people simply don't have the cash on hand to buy these expensive investments up front. Farmers were frequently reluctant to sign formal agreements, but competition amongst folks selling farm equipment forced them to continue to reduce down payment prices, make more favorable terms for farmers, and really compete with one another as they were trying to sell these new tools. This eventually led to some pretty significant losses for these companies selling these tools, as farmers did not always pay back or pay back on time. But generally speaking, farmers did pay when they could, but repayment often took more than a year. If you imagine that you are a farmer, you have one season of crop. If you're not able to make the repayment after that season, you essentially have to wait a whole other year before you have income that you can use to pay off the balance. And so these payment plans often went on much longer than intended, were rather informal, and led to some significant losses. But there was simply no way for farmers to buy this equipment without these plans. And so the producers of farm equipment were forced to continue to sell these things on more and more favorable terms for farmers. This Bill is now going to step in with a few comments about the effect of these payment plans.
Yeah, so this was obviously hugely essential, as Kelly said, to being able to do this and to continue farming. Capitalizing farming and agriculture was necessary at this point. But it had some pretty significant impacts and blowback. And unsurprisingly, as basically happens under capitalism, this would eventually lead to the start of pretty significant consolidation into, you know, away from family farms and into the subsequent agribusiness corporations, some of which we've actually talked about with, you know, things like the sugar industry and so forth that were already starting to emerge. As with any of these things, if it required more capital intensive investment upfront earlier, it was going to turn into that earlier. And this was sort of an inevitability for everything. But the farmers themselves, not very good credit risks. They were continuing to, quote unquote, buy, if not repay, huge amounts of farm equipment over this period. And that's something we've actually talked about before. So farm equipment and credit financing had a profound effect on the United States and basically all Americans, not just in how it brought mechanical capital to agriculture, but also how these associated debts and, of course, the rising production levels, which Kelly wasn't really addressing there, but she did mention the debts, ended up contributing eventually to a sector collapse in the agricultural sector, which lasted for several years. And that brought much of the American population to the brink of starvation for a few years in the 1890s. That's when you start seeing soup kitchens and community garden campaigns and so forth. And then things eventually kind of balance out as production levels fall back down, the prices then go down, and you have more of these corporate consolidations over previously family farming. Not, you know, extensively to the level we have now, but certainly a lot greater than it had been. So I want to recap a point that we made on our July 2020 episode on the Long Depression of the 1870s, 1880s, and into the 1890s. And we talked on that episode about how the 1890s, the early 1890s, ended up being kind of a bookend for that period. And there were bad things that followed that economically, but it was a different type of bad things. And as I said on that episode, the 1890s was notably distinct from and put an end to the earlier period because there was a wide-scale exit from agricultural production by farmers who had been struggling for the two previous decades with capital debts, mounting prices for shipping and storage of grain in the rail industry, and falling grain prices due to vast overproduction. And of course, the arrival of significant industrial mechanization in the 1870s, especially after wartime labor shortages had spurred mechanical innovation. The total value of all farm machinery nationwide rose by nearly $250 million from 1860 to 1890. By 1889, American manufacturers were producing $81 million worth of farm machinery annually compared to $17 million per year in 1859 before the Civil War. And that's all Census Bureau data from a 1927 Congressional Research Service report. So again, that was something we had talked about on a previous episode, much like we talked about Singer sewing machine installment plans on a previous episode, much like we talked about record players and pianos and so forth being sold on installment plans. So you can see sort of a through line here. And in this episode, we're, of course, trying to address more of why that was so necessary, why it had to involve these installment plans and credit plans, because as Kelly said, or as Kelly suggested, this is not just a, you know, people being extravagant and profligate or something. It's often that they did not have the ability to do this without, as Calder puts it in the book, essentially collapsing time, which of course is what the entire economy is now, which is one reason that I was interested in pursuing this as a mini series, you know, of course, thinking about, you know, present versus the origins of this. Today, most of the economy is increasingly these consumer finance plans, monthly payment plans for everything, subscription services, and so on and so forth. And all of it is based around the idea of collapsing time, borrowing time from the future, eliminating time as a concept. So you get a lump sum money now by basically borrowing, either officially or de facto, against future revenue streams and incomes and things like that. And that is the phenomenon that we are starting to see in this period that we're looking at now. Later in the series, we'll be talking about things like the rise of auto loans, which of course is the ultimate culmination of emerging consumer credit and capital equipment installment plans like these farm equipment plans. But we're not quite there yet, but I just want you to be able to see where we're going with this. And again, the way that all of this functions, whether it's in 1890 or in, 2020, 2021, is this idea of, well, it's okay that you don't have the money on hand right now, and we're going to give you the money from the future, and so that you can buy things now, and then you'll just pay more and spread it out over time. And there will either be, explicitly in the form of some sort of a financial loan instrument, or less officially, or at least more obscured in the form of various sort of payment plans and things like that. And again, you can see the origins of that beginning to emerge here. And we're going to continue as we go through this series talking more and more about how that plays out. So I want to pause here, though, and talk about what we've just been discussing with these installment plans, the rise of these sort of retail installment stores, who are replicating the work of the peddlers on the streets, as well as this farm equipment. So, Rachel, I'll go back to you to figure out, did you have any observations on this or things that you had thought about as you were reading through this?
Yeah, I was kind of thinking about how previously debt was seen as kind of a moral failure, but it seems like here it's kind of transformed into kind of a necessity, and less of a moral failure or a vice. I do think it was good in that it did provide these low and middle income families with goods that they previously couldn't access. And I think with the rise of things like payment plans for pianos and sewing machines, I think it did turn out to be a net good, because they were able to access things and pieces of culture that previously were closed off to them. So I can see how it could kind of be seen as profligate spending, like you mentioned earlier, but it just really had kind of become a necessity. It's kind of interesting. I'm sure there were interest rates involved, but it didn't really mention them as being outrageously high. So I'm assuming the interest rates were relatively low, so it wasn't like cleaning.
You would be incorrect on that point, as we'll get into. But not to give everything away now. And I want to say we're gonna definitely return in our final episode of the series, which will be two episodes from a couple episodes from now. We're going to talk more about that cultural shift that you're alluding to here. This idea of, like, in the past, in like the late Middle Ages or whatever, debt would be either, this sort of investment debt where you were, borrowing to set up a business, or you were borrowing for various farm activities and things like that. Or it was this, you had a gambling debt or something like that, right? That kind of profligate debt, or in the upper ranks of the nobility, you would see that sort of really profligate spending where they were borrowing well beyond their means to buy various fancy clothes and so forth. And that was in some cases a deliberate strategy, Louis the 14th, for example, obviously making everyone come to the Palace of Versailles and spend all of their money constantly on the newest fashions so that they wouldn't have that money available to raise mercenary armies against him. There's a bit of a clever strategy there. But as you allude to, at the beginning of the period that we're talking about today, in the United States especially, because the situation obviously culturally a little bit different in the United States from Europe, as we're about to talk about with some specific areas, culturally there was still a lot of resistance to this idea of borrowing money to spend on consumer things. The book repeatedly makes the distinction between consumptive credit and consumer credit. Consumer credit was the rebranding of consumptive credit that had previously been really looked down on. And as I said, we will circle back to talk more about that on a subsequent episode of this series, because that cultural shift is really important. But I want to underscore here the key point, which is that that cultural shift was in large part driven by the necessities of the changing economy. We've done so many episodes on this point on things like, you know, yeah, sure, some things that would be little luxuries like record players or whatever, but also really basic things like canned foods and new, you know, clothing, things like that, right? There's all these different things. There's that whole book that we've been quoting from periodically, that Gordon book on the consumer economy and, you know, charting the rise of these totally new things that were available for sale. And yes, some of them were not necessities, but a lot of them were. They were new types of food that were more expensive, often higher quality, often significantly more nutritious. People's diets improved substantially over this period. And in many cases, as we're about to talk about in a few minutes with some of the really sort of low-income people and industrial laborers, in many cases, borrowing was their only way to pay for a lot of these things, right? If you didn't want to be starving in rags in an unfurnished apartment, you were going to at some point need to be borrowing through some form or another, whether it was installment plans, whether it was store credit, or whether it was some of these less savory loans that we will be talking about. So I think that's all kind of important to understand that all of these transformations are happening together in tandem and are reinforcing each other. Kelly, I want to go back to you to get your thoughts on some of this that we've just talked about.
Yeah, very similar to all that. I think the line between lending that is like a social good and predatory lending is just so fine since the beginning of lending practices. I mean, on the one hand, like I was getting a lot of It's a Wonderful Life vibes from these readings, thinking about George Bailey, you know, trying to just make sure people have like a safe, neat house to live in versus, you know, the constant indebtedness of people who were borrowing on unfavorable terms. And so I think that when we talk about sort of credit practices today, that conversation is still very, very relevant and very real. And it's just interesting to see it, you know, date back hundreds of years to the initiation of these sorts of systems.
Yeah. And as you say, you know, there's obviously, as we're going to talk about in a few minutes, the really egregious, like openly, blatantly unfavorable terms. But in general, almost all of this was unfavorable terms. And that had been true going back to, you know, Frontier General stores before the Civil War, where the prices were insanely high on everything. And so people just had to kind of make do without a lot of the time. And the reason was not necessarily intentional predatory behavior. It was that, you know, if you know that you're going to not get paid in full for an item that you yourself as the middleman had to purchase from a manufacturer or a supplier, you're going to have to charge more money to make up for the fact that you probably had to borrow money yourself to cover that gap in between in time, you know, but while you're waiting for the harvest profits to come in and that kind of thing, right? And we talked a little bit about that last week, but that's still a recurring force here. And that is also true when we're talking about the urban stores as well, right? In many cases, and I guess you could argue that ultimately there is somebody at the end of the chain who's definitely being predatory, right? The big version of the loan sharks, which is the high interest loans from the major banks and financial institutions in places like New York. And they were financing all of these middlemen merchant activities happening, whether it was in the cities or on the frontier. And in order to do that, they were charging significant interest rates because there was this significant problem of being able to collect payments at all, and definitely to collect payments in a timely manner. And so I think that's really important to understand here. And in many cases, the difference between the cash price for something and the payment plan price for something was quite substantial as a percentage difference. And that, I think, gets to the point that Rachel was asking about earlier. So I want to talk now a little bit about book credit and running accounts. I think this one is probably, of all the different things that we've been talking about in researching for this series, this is probably the most sort of familiar and intuitive to people. And of course, we still use the phrase, you know, keeping a running account and that sort of thing. And this had been a practice in place before the Civil War, and it remained in force even after, you know, the rise and fall of Civil War era paper money and the de-emphasis of paper money after Reconstruction. And in many cases, book credit, basically keeping a ledger of, you know, here's what someone quote unquote bought from me but didn't pay for, and, you know, did I collect the money from them yet? That really was the only way of grappling with those severe shortages of specie, the precious metal coinage from the government that was in circulation, or I should say not in circulation, almost everywhere in the United States at this time. And that's the point that I tried to make multiple times in parts one and two in last week's episode on this, is that you cannot understand any of this without understanding that there just was not enough money physically in circulation to be able to sustain a lot of the necessary activities. And again, you know, you have in the pre-Civil War period, tons of deflationary pressure from insufficient money going around. You have a lot of people just deciding to do without and so forth. But that is simply not going to work in a consumer-driven economy that we see during the Second Industrial Revolution. You have to have people, and granted, it was still a very deflationary period, and we're going to talk more about that when we get to things like the Cross of Gold and the silver movement in more detail. There was a lot of pressure, obviously, to try to fix that situation, but there was a necessity to come up with what we would today refer to as financial instruments and financial options for consumers. You had to come up with that, or else the entire thing was going to grind to a halt. And that's what had happened multiple times in the pre-Civil War period, is that all economic activity would basically just shut down for a few years. Everyone would lose their jobs. No one would be buying anything. And you'd just have this vicious cycle until something came along that could sort of kickstart it. And unfortunately, a lot of that tended to be some wave of financial speculation, or ultimately what ends up catalyzing this entire period that we're talking about today and what we've been talking about for the past couple years on the show, is the Second Industrial Revolution gets kickstarted by the ignition switch of the government needing to spend enormous amounts of money to do the Civil War, to successfully prosecute and win the Civil War. The Northern government has to spend huge amounts of money, you know, paying people to build factories, to build arms, to build canned foods, to produce all of, you know, uniforms, things like that. All of these things end up becoming important features of the post-Civil War consumer economy, but then you still need a consumer base that can buy things. And if they don't have the option of buying things with cash on hand, you're going to run into some problems. The early solution, again, had been book credit, and that continued to sort of evolve and ebb and flow during this period. This was something that was utilized by people in the cities, as well as people on the rural frontier and the countryside. It was used by the middle classes. It was used by the working classes. And that is a distinction as well. As Rachel mentioned earlier, with installment plans, obviously installment plans end up becoming basically the bedrock of middle class life in America. But there was a period where this was really looked down on, especially culturally, and that one of the things that made you kind of middle class was that you had a little bit more sort of cash on hand in lump sums to be able to make major purchases in that era before the period that we see this transformation happening in. And the big distinction between that and the book credit is that the book credit was definitely used by middle class people pretty much without a second thought. So in rural areas, this took the form of like a general store ledger. But in urban areas, you wouldn't have a general store. You'd have all kinds of specialized stores, and they would each have one of these ledgers. So you'd have your grocer, your butcher, your baker, that sort of thing. And you'd go in, you'd buy something. It was called buying on tick, because they would tick off your name and say, oh, you made another purchase. And then at some point you were supposed to settle up. Now, as we've talked about before, in rural areas, you're going to settle up relatively infrequently because it really depends on when money comes in from the harvest. In the urban areas, it's going to be more likely on a monthly basis, or sometimes more frequently, sometimes less frequently, depending on, you know, whether they thought they could get the money from the person, or how the economy was doing, whether there had been layoffs and so forth. And again, one of the things that we see happening during this period is just a general growth of the middle class itself, because as we've talked about on previous episodes with the Second Industrial Revolution, one of the big features after the mid-century is that you have this administrative economy developing of tons of new white-collar jobs that had never previously existed. These weren't these skilled craft jobs. They weren't store clerk and store owner type jobs. These were the office jobs that start emerging, you know, running the telegraph systems, taking the messages, transmitting the messages, filling out forms, making copies of the forms, using your new forms of cheap industrial paper, your new typewriters, things like that. You get all these new things that allow the creation of these white collar, middle class salaried jobs. And of course, as you can see where I'm going with this, the salaried jobs are very secure compared to definitely the farm labor, but also the industrial labor with their much less sort of reliable situation. Now, although Rachel mentioned earlier that there were eventually department stores definitely getting in on the action with installment plans and things like that, there was a period initially at the beginning of department stores where that was not the case. And partly that's a reputational thing, as Rachel mentioned. But a lot of that is just that they really didn't like how expensive it was to extend people credit, whether it was eventually an installment plan or simply the earlier system of letting people buy things on tick, you know, write it down in a ledger, and then they'll settle up accounts. It's very expensive to do that. You have to be able to float a lot of money between getting your receivables paid back, right? And you're going to have to be paying your accounts payable in the meantime. So that's an expensive proposition. And so the department stores initially tried the approach of forcing everyone to buy everything on cash. That was one of the big key features of department stores when they initially launched. Everything was cash only. It was vastly cheaper, and that was their big selling point. But you had to pay upfront in full. That was it, right? You did not have an option otherwise. And they tried this really hard for quite a few years, the 1870s, 1880s, and so forth. Most of them were trying to make this a thing, and it was not working for them. Eventually, they decided that they had to yield to this, as Rachel said, and start doing, whether it was installment plans or charge accounts or what have you, because, simply put, people, as Kelly said, did not have the money on hand, right? You can't sell goods to people if they don't have the money on hand. It's not just a matter of, oh, these people can't delay gratification. It's they're never going to be able to put together the amount of money that they need. What they can do is come up with 25 cents a week, or if they're middle class, maybe a dollar a week or whatever, right? They can put together some amount of money per week to pay their bills and to buy things. And this was also adopted by the stores that had previously been on the ledger system as opposed to cash only, because open book credit had a major drawback for the vendors besides all the drawbacks that we've already mentioned. And that is that if the customer in debt actually went bankrupt, which certainly did happen, their retail creditors would be treated the same as any other creditor. And so they probably wouldn't get paid back. So all that stuff that they had quote unquote sold would basically have been sold for free because they never got paid back. And they, you know, if they were lucky, they'd get a fraction of it, right? Today we'd call it pennies on the dollar, but of course back then it would be even less because of inflation since then. But by contrast, installment plans had an attractive feature for these stores that had been working on an open book credit. And that was that they had already gotten paid, you know, and recouped a lot of the price of the item sold. Maybe they hadn't gotten the full value of the item, but that's okay because they were also greatly increasing the price of the item. And so, you know, you'd get a significant portion of it back and hopefully not lose money or not too much money on the deal if someone went bankrupt. And you wouldn't be waiting weeks, months, or years for the customer to either have enough cash on hand to settle up or to hopefully climb out of bankruptcy if they had actually gone bankrupt. And so that was sort of the open book credit system and the evolution sort of away from that gradually. But still, we see that running accounts become, in stores that didn't end up adopting the installment plans, they end up becoming the origins of things like charge accounts and subsequently later on store cards, things like that, store credit cards. It was interesting. In this book, it mentioned a lot of these stores really resisted for as long as possible letting people buy things on credit and finance. But eventually they realized it was just not feasible, not realistic, and it was simply not competitive against the stores that were offering this. So I want to pause here again and ask this sort of cultural question. Did people think of this system of store credit running accounts as money or borrowing? Because we can recognize that today as essentially being that, or at least I think we can, right? Maybe some people don't really think of it that way. But I'm not sure that they necessarily understood it as such. And I think that contributes as well to the cultural shift. If you have this sort of liminal space between the, you know, oh, you should never be borrowing money to, you know, buy consumer goods because that's wasteful and profligate and it's not a good investment, versus the later system of, oh, you should buy everything on consumer credit and finance. It's okay. You're just borrowing from your future earnings. Don't even worry about it, right? You have this sort of thing in the middle that everyone's already used to, which is a system where you go get something from the store, but you don't have to pay for it immediately. You do have to pay for it later, and it's going to be more expensive. We understand from looking at it from the vendor side and the creditor side in that chain that I previously described of the financiers and so forth, we understand that that was effectively a system of loaning people money, right? You're manipulating time again, but kind of in a different direction. I don't know that people necessarily understood that as borrowing, but it would have set up, I think, later them to be primed to say, oh, well, this is just a reorganized form of the store credit or buying on tick or the running account on the ledger. It's just a different way of doing it. So it's fine. I was already buying things this way. No big deal. And I think that helps get over that hump that we'll talk about in the later episode, where basically there was a lot of propaganda around the idea that you should never, ever be in debt. You should only spend within your means and so forth. You should only spend based on cash on hand. And again, you can say that they made some good points with some of that, but in some of that, it was not realistic to the time period and the economic situation. So Kelly, I'll go to you first on this. What sort of jumps to your mind as you think about this book credit and running account system and how it evolved during this period?
Yeah, to your sort of point about the cultural question here, what strikes me is that folks who do not have cash on hand but needed these farming tools to stay competitive, needed, you know, what they needed in the urban environment to be able to continue to keep themselves and their families housed and safe, they strike me as very much in survival mode and probably not that interested in like calculating the cost of interest over the long term, or the philosophical questions about borrowing that we sort of have the luxury of exploring today. And so I'm struck by how much of a necessity this became in such a short amount of time, that people really did rely on credit for their basic needs and sort of keeping themselves and their families afloat.
Rachel?
Well, like was mentioned in the introduction of the book, this was like a transitional time where people had to like reconceptualize what money was. And it was really confusing for a lot of people. That quote from the 1840s, like most people just didn't think about it because they couldn't conceive of what money was. So what seems so simple for us today was probably pretty complicated and hard to think about. Much like thinking about modern monetary policy is kind of confusing to today's people. So it's really interesting to think about how much money changed in such a short amount of time that it probably was a little too complicated to think about and to conceive of what they were doing as a form of money handling. Because it just was so intangible at that time. Like the introduction to the book said, you could bite or melt down your metal money, but this is kind of virtual money. And so it seems a little less real. And so maybe it was harder to think about it as moving money around, buying these things on tick. So it's really interesting to kind of put yourself into the mindset of a 19th century consumer at that time.
So far, we've talked about the money forms, the accounting, the finance that was all sort of fully legal, above board. Maybe people would occasionally disparage it, but it was generally seen as accepted and increasingly became more and more acceptable as time went on. It was also something that was a very middle class thing, in addition to being something that poor farmers and industrial wage laborers would be using. But this brings us now to the seedier side of things, which we do need to talk about because it definitely, I think, doesn't get as much attention. And that's the topic of loan sharks, pawn shops, small dollar lenders, and so forth. And this is when we really get into what Kelly alluded to earlier as people being in survival mode and just, you know, you got to sign the paper and make this transaction happen because you're desperate. So these lenders, as you might imagine, were quite high interest, much, much higher interest, especially given the amounts of money involved than some of the things that we've talked about so far. It's important to note here, as Calder does throughout the book, that the reason that these small dollar loans or other sort of financial instruments were high interest is that it wasn't purely for exploitation of people, right? Obviously, that was an element of it. But there were other factors. Firstly, a lot of it was illegal or somewhat illegal, and so there's an incentive to charge a higher amount of money. But secondly, there is just a simple reality of high overhead costs of the business relative to the size of the loan being made, right? If you're loaning someone $500 or $1,000 for some sort of business enterprise thing, you can afford to charge a relatively low interest rate and still cover not just your own profits to your investors and so forth, but just literally like paying the office clerks to keep track of the transactions, keep the paperwork, to do the research on your credit worthiness and things like that, which is something we'll talk about in a few minutes, or just to even have the staff person at the desk who fills out the paperwork, right? That you can afford to charge lower interest rates on a big loan and still make money that covers that because it's a large amount of money to begin with. When you're dealing with a small dollar loan, right, a $5 loan, a $10 loan, $15 loan, something like that, or even really smaller amounts at this time in many cases, you have to charge a high interest rate even if you have the best of intentions, which is going to become important as we talk about this, because you still have to pay the person who sits at the desk filling out the paperwork, the person who keeps the records, the person who goes around trying to find out where their payments are to, you know, get the loan repaid and so forth. All of that adds up to and certainly office space, which was often in very shady parts of town, kind of out of the way. This all adds up to a high overhead cost per loan. And so as a matter of necessity, you sort of have to charge a high interest loan. And you might say to yourself, well, you never have to. But the reality is there were actually many attempts during this period to try to create sort of legal, more reputable alternatives to these more shady enterprises. And the problem that they ran into basically every single time was it is not financially viable, even if you're operating it almost as like a nonprofit or a not-for-profit. It is not financially viable to make these small dollar loans to these urban industrial laborers and their families at a reasonable interest rate. You cannot cover the costs necessary to actually make the loan because of your overhead of your physical space and your employees and all of that. Now, usury laws were still on the books and often enforced in many parts of the United States during this period, unlike in Europe. This is one of the big sort of cultural divergences in Europe. Obviously, there had been a long sort of usury taboo, if not legal, outright prohibition in Europe for a long time. And some of that started to be circumvented as early as like the 1400s and so forth in mainstream. And then you have the Protestant Reformation and things like that. But even so, there was a period where usury was still generally quite frowned upon. And you would get some, even some of the pretty hardcore Protestants would, you know, look down on usury and say that this was a morally bankrupt practice and so forth. But there was in the mid-19th century a pretty significant campaign, I guess. It's only alluded to in passing in the book because it's not really the subject of the book. But in Europe, there was an effort to roll back a lot of these usury laws. And so mostly they were gone by the middle of the 19th century. That was not the case in the United States. And these laws, which were often at the state level, as we've talked about, there wasn't a whole lot happening at the federal level until this period. State laws were generally avoided by making an interest-free loan and then charging a whole bunch of fees to basically cover what would be interest. But the other thing is that the author argues that the continued existence of usury laws until American reforms happened in the early 20th century did make enough of the industry unprofitable except by illegal activities that unsavory loan sharks became an essential source of financing in many ordinary people's lives. And this is a harder point to research, it's argued in this book, because of how much it was not really discussed, not done out in the open, not advertised in the newspapers. But it was something that became essential, right? As long as those usury laws were on the books, they weren't necessarily actually protecting consumers, because in many cases, they were just forcing everything into this illegal black market because the economic imperatives were such that you couldn't do a low-interest, usury-free lending system to fill these credit needs. And this led to the black market, which then charged higher rates. Many desperate poor people in American cities ended up paying huge sums to illegal lenders. And I think it's important to talk about here that small loan lenders emerge as a direct outgrowth of industrialization and the rise of industrial wage labor in the 18th and 19th century. Obviously, I mentioned that quote earlier when I was quoting from those two pages in the book about the person referring to the financing of the time, and it was a contemporary writing at the time, that money isn't just money. It is your clothing, it is your food, it is your shelter, and so forth. That is important to understand when you're talking about this transformation in the labor market as well. Paychecks might be more frequent for an industrial laborer than an agricultural harvest would be, but they were still unreliable, and they were subject to various catastrophes, sudden firings, plant closures, strikes, horrific injuries, illness preventing you from doing your job, etc. So where pre-industrial farmers might subsist and meet most of their needs within their own farm, and then they don't have to go buy things off of the farm, and therefore they don't need credit extended to them, it's not the same for an industrial laborer. Their entire life was dominated, as Calder explains, by the need to earn and spend money on everything: food, housing, clothing, and obviously little luxuries you can take or leave, but they needed cash on hand, not necessarily at convenient times, and their life was extremely precarious. So into that breach stepped these small dollar lenders, especially in the second half of the 19th century. And people could pawn their property for various lengths of time, sometimes quite briefly, like even less than a week, or they could sign away the rights to their future earnings on a relatively steady paycheck for a discounted lump sum in the present. Newspapers were filled with ads for pawn shops and so-called wage assignment businesses. You were assigning part of your or all of your paycheck to them, were often illegal, and they did not advertise. And in fact, they were so illegal that you could, in some cases, have situations where employers were urged to or sometimes required by law to fire anyone that had signed over their paycheck to one of these lenders if they found out about it and caught them. And this was a subject of heated debate when there eventually were reform campaigns to try to make people's lives less miserable and provide them the sort of necessary emergency credit options that they needed. There were some fairly unsuccessful attempts to serve the poor's need for short-term small-dollar finance through various so-called charity shops or philanthropically subsidized low-cost lenders. These would be sort of like what I said of attempting to do like a nonprofit model before that really existed for this space. But these really mostly didn't go anywhere for the reasons I've already talked about. It just financially didn't really work and didn't really serve the needs. There was also often a moral, like, character assessment component to this. I mean, if you're somebody that's got to go to a loan shark on a regular basis, you've probably got some issues going on anyway that are going to lead them to say, oh, you're not of good moral character and standing. Or they would try to get real busybody about it and tell you how to, like, manage your household finances better and stuff like that. And, you know, maybe they were making some good points, but at a certain point, it's just kind of paternalistic and condescending. So people don't really like that. So it just didn't really go anywhere. The chattel lending or pawn shop industry, where you would be pawning your property, was interesting in this period because some families would pawn property like clothing during the week and then retrieve it for the weekends, hoping that the shop didn't burn down with all the inventory in the meantime, which it sometimes did. And that was sometimes how people found out that a family member had been pawning things during the week. And unfortunately, all of this seems just terribly inefficient and expensive, which kind of goes back to a point we've talked about many times before, which is that truism that it's really expensive to be poor. if you were more middle class, you wouldn't need these options most of the time, unless you like had a gambling problem or something like that. And, you know, you could go and borrow money from friends and family if you needed to. And indeed, many of these sort of worker families and immigrant families often tried to do that first, right? They would try to go around, you know, find some mutual aid or some charity from some of their fellow immigrants, or they'd, you know, be basically loaning each other money back and forth to pay off bills. But at a certain point, sometimes you're going to need to go, you know, go to the pawn shop or go to one of these loan sharks. It's the same thing as people going to payday loans today. And the upshot of this is, as I said, it's just very expensive if you're one of these poor laborers or their spouse or children. I thought this was an interesting part of the book in general. I mean, it's basically a through line through much of the book, but that was the part that I learned the most from, because unlike, say, you know, general store credit or something like that, it wasn't really something I had heard much about. It was basically new information to me. And it was filled with a lot of anecdotes and research. Some of them are from other academics, and he's sort of summarizing, and I'm not going to take the time, since the episode is already a long one anyway, to summarize all of that here. So I would encourage listeners to check out the book if they can get a copy. It's called Financing the American Dream by Lendahl Calder in 1999. And you can read it for yourself and sort of learn more about this sort of gray market and black market of these small dollar loans. I was especially surprised to read about how many of these small dollar lenders apparently employed women in a combination of white collar and not very white collar functions at these firms. And these were sometimes employed as enforcers instead of using, you know, your classic enforcer of a big muscle guy. These companies basically gambled that using women to collect on late payments and enforce unpleasant fees was A, somewhat less likely to provoke debtors to physical violence toward them, and B, they could publicly embarrass and shame a debtor in front of his family and friends if necessary when trying to collect a bill. So I'll pause there and go back to you, Rachel. You know, you read some of this as well, but there were definitely large sections of the book that I just simply couldn't include, or else in our materials, or else I would have been copying the entire book. But this was sort of an interesting dimension that I hadn't really heard anything about before.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting, the wage assignment businesses. It seems like a few companies have kind of stepped into that breach today. There's like applications or like credit. I guess it seems like almost a credit card that does these like check advancement schemes. So that kind of sounds very similar to what was going on back then, where you can kind of borrow against your future check a couple days before payday or something. So it's kind of interesting how some things stay the same, even if they appear to be different. Also, it seems like pawn shops were definitely kind of a trope of the time. I remember that famous O. Henry short story where the Gift of the Magi pawns the husband's watch to afford a Christmas present. So it seems like it was a big part of life back then, in a way that it really isn't today, because there are these kind of different mechanisms for advancing your wages now.
Yeah, and that is, one of the reasons why we're doing this series, is because I've been increasingly sort of fixated by the totalizing financialization of the modern global economy, and especially the American economy. One of these elements that is particularly nefarious is this graduation from the sort of much maligned but politically powerful payday loan industry into, now it's payday loans for everyone, including the white collar middle classes. But it's okay because it's an app on your phone, so it's not actually payday loans, and it's not as shady as, you know, going down to the strip mall outlet or the pawn shop or whatever. It's okay. It's all on your phone. It's financial tech. Therefore, it's legitimate. It's just a different kind of banking. And we're democratizing credit, which, of course, no, you're not. You're just doing the same thing that these outlets and institutions were doing in the late 1800s, which is, you're not democratizing credit. You're just providing credit into a niche where there's desperate people who are willing to pay through the nose because they're desperate and they don't have a lot of resources, or you've marketed it to them in such a way. One of the big features of this book is going through newspaper advertisements and the constant marketing of easy terms, easy terms, you know, no money down, or, you know, very, you know, reasonable interest rates, minimal fees, things like that. And of course, that was not the case in most of this, right? They were lying. But that was the similar pitch, right? You make, and then similarly to today, as with the installment plans, and this is what we're going to talk about on the final episode of the series later, is you get this cultural propagandizing element around it. Rather than the culture changing from the material factors, you try to change the culture in order to sell something. And you say, oh, well, you're going to be able to buy furniture. You're going to be able to buy this, you know, piece of clothing that you want or whatever. And you just, we'll give you these good terms. Don't even worry about it. You'll be able to afford this. And it'll be a little bit more expensive than if you paid cash, but you're never going to have that cash on hand. So we've got you covered and so forth. And I think the parallels are very clear to the present day. Kelly?
Yeah. And to Rachel's earlier point about putting this in the context of a 19th century consumer, given what you both have discussed in earlier episodes about sort of like the fluidity of money and, you know, wildcat banks and wildcat notes, it is fascinating to me how somebody without like a concrete definition of what money even is would navigate these systems and these like rapidly evolving financial institutions.
Absolutely. And I think there's also, again, this key point is if you are now living in an entirely cash-based economy in an industrial city, and you have to pay things in cash, and there's simply not enough cash floating around, and you're certainly not getting paid enough cash on a regular basis, and you don't have access to banking that will pay you in cash, how are you going to get cash when you need it in a pinch? You're going to go to a wage assignment business or a loan shark or a pawn shop or something like that, because they have managed to get their hands on some cold hard cash, and they can help you settle up your accounts. And that was a key pitch that was being made here. In a more explicit way than in the sort of less industrial, less wage labor driven areas of like the farm country in the United States. Now, Kelly, one of the interesting things in this period, it starts to be the emergence of credit reporting, which you did some research on. And obviously, this is going to become a massive force in the early 20th century period as consumer credit comes into its own sort of sectoral thing that people can understand and readily access. And we're going to talk about that on another episode. But it actually has a much longer history because these stores, these businesses, these middlemen, and even some of these payday loan type operations of the 19th century, one thing that they needed to do was do research on their debtors, on their clients, and figure out what their credit risk was, whether they could pay back the amount of money that was being loaned, and that sort of thing. So Kelly, could you tell us about the history of credit reporting, or at least the origins of it, before we get to this huge consumer credit period that we're going to be saving for another episode?
Absolutely. So one of like the, I'm not going to call it aha moments, but more of like a why haven't I ever thought of this before moments sort of happened while doing this reading. And just all of these sort of like credit systems and loaning and the fact that like money has any sort of specific value that we take for granted today. I was like, why haven't I ever thought of this before? And so then I began to think about something that's like personally quite interesting to me, which is credit reporting. And so I wondered how, as these loaning systems were evolving, how did folks providing credit know how to loan to and who is likely to pay them back? Equifax, which is now one of the big three credit score reports, was born in 1899 and by 1920 had offices around the country, with literally millions of index cards that had newspaper clippings of promotions for people, arrests, et cetera. And this is what determined creditworthiness. However, even before the beginning of Equifax, there were systems that predated them. And I'm not going to go all the way back because apparently some sort of credit scores go all the way back to Roman times. But I do think it's worth noting the first sort of viable credit score agency in the United States, which was in 1864, the Mercantile Agency, which would later become R.G. Dunn & Company, created a formal system for ranking the worthiness of companies to loan to. And a central and fascinating figure of the Mercantile Agency was its founder, Lewis Tappan. Tappan was a strict Calvinist who insisted on cash transactions for the first part of his career. And this was because the Bible warned against lending money and charging interest. So I think that, like, as we talk about the cultural evolution towards money, it's worth noting that a lot of the hesitancy towards credit transactions came from the Bible, supposedly, in this Calvinist movement. I'm going to read a brief bio here on Louis Tappan, which comes from PBS. In 1830, the Tappans met a young abolitionist agitator named William Lloyd Garrison, whom Arthur offered financial support. Soon the brothers, and that's the Tappan brothers, were part of a nationwide network opposing slavery. Their new crusade made them the hated targets of many merchants and white laborers, who believed ending slavery would destroy the cotton export business and allow freed slaves to take scarce jobs. By 1834, mobs were storming Lewis's home and Arthur's store. Faced with the boycott and lost business, the Tappans were forced to extend credit for the first time. Then, in the panic of 1837, the business was wiped out. By 1839, Arthur had repaid all his creditors, and the business was shakily back on its feet. Lewis hated credit, but he realized offering it to customers was becoming the only way to make a sale. How could a merchant gauge his customers' trustworthiness and assess whether he'd ever get paid? Tappan began keeping files on customers, reviewing their characters and their creditworthiness. Pretty soon, other merchants were turning to Tappan for advice. Exploiting his abolitionist connections across the country, Tappan created a network of correspondents to offer up-to-date and comprehensive credit information about people in their communities. And by 1841, they had 280 clients. And by 1859, they had over 2,000 correspondents across the country, sort of reporting back on people's trustworthiness, etc. Tappan eventually retired wealthy and spent his retirement continuing to fight slavery. He would later die 10 years after the Emancipation Proclamation. So I just thought this was particularly fascinating, this history of how credit reports came to be and how they literally, you know, without, of course, like big data or databases or computers, they relied on what they read in the newspaper and what they heard in the community. In order to sort of keep tabs on people's trustworthiness. It's worth noting that while some sort of credit reporting through Tappan and his correspondence was available, it was not used like it was used today. Research found that even when the information was available, it wasn't always accessed until something had gone wrong, either sort of a system-wide economic issue or an individual event that caused creditworthiness to go into to be called into account. And so from some FDIC research, first subscribers only acquired a fraction of the reports that the agency supplied, even though the information was inexpensive and easily available to subscribers. Second, when they did access credit reports, subscribers were more likely to do so after an adverse shock to the aggregate economy or the individual borrower. And the final finding was subscribers were more likely to acquire information about a borrower if one of the subscribers' other borrowers defaulted. And so just worth noting that while the credit system itself was evolving, so was the idea of credit worthiness and even how lenders were using that credit worthiness.
Thanks. And I think that this all really points to several interesting things that are happening as the economy and society evolves during this period, essentially. So you have, first of all, everything is becoming depersonalized and individualized in a couple different ways. So it's depersonalized in the sense that you're needing to evaluate over longer networks, right? We're seeing now we have railroads and telegraphs. There's economic activity happening over longer distances. You don't know the people yourself personally. You might not even know someone who knows that person. So you need to start establishing these sort of networks to evaluate this. Initially, as you mentioned, this is a sort of business credit assessment thing, which would itself be similar to, you know, ancient methods of credit worthiness assessments, which tended to be for very large, you know, moneyed individuals, right? The rich nobility or some very particularly rich middle class figure. And the this evolves into individual credit assessments as that becomes more pertinent, right? As you have individuals who are borrowing money in relatively smaller amounts, sometimes they're using it to start a business, but in some cases they're not. And then also what we see here, that this feature that you mentioned at the end, is that unlike how it's used today, a lot of times it sounds like how they were using it was after something went wrong, which, why would you need it then? Well, because you're going to renegotiate with that person, right? So you look at it, if they have some problem, and you say either, I need all the money back right now, or you say, it's okay, I know you can't pay me back on the schedule we had agreed to, but I'm willing to renegotiate terms. You can pay me back later. Here's the arrangement we'll use for that. And I know that you're good for it because I've done this credit check on you and so forth. And that, I think, is an interesting series of things that are happening here. Rachel, before we wrap this up, I want to get your thoughts on this point, these points that Kelly's brought up.
Yeah, it's really interesting that even though the information was available, it wasn't really accessed, which is very different from today, where your credit score is inquired about very frequently and oftentimes for very minimal things. Even just like looking into maybe getting a credit card can ding your credit score because you're inquiring, which can put a hit on your credit report. So it's very interesting that there weren't these kind of mechanisms in place that really affected your credit score unless something bad happened or in the economy or overall or to as for you as an individual. So it's kind of interesting to see how different it is today, where the data is available and it's getting accessed basically all the time by multiple parties. So it's kind of interesting to see that contrast.
Well, this episode has definitely run on the longer side, but I think it's been a really fascinating one and sort of got a lot of the points in that I wanted to talk about and have us thinking about as part of this series and kind of why we're doing this series. But I did want to go around one more time and give you both the option to sort of make overall reflections on this section of the series. As I said, we'll be moving on next to talk again about the monetary policy debates in the government and the politics around that, which we talked somewhat about through the Reconstruction era last time. And then we will be returning to this idea of consumptive credit, consumer credit, and things like that emerging in the turn of the century, early 20th century, as we wrap up the series. But I want to go to you, Kelly. Overall reflections on this section. You weren't on last week, but you can sort of see how the pieces are all coming together.
Yeah, of course. I think I do think that we, spend so much time in school and everywhere else discussing the technological advances at this time and how that changed society. So I'm just grateful for the opportunity to uncover how the financial institutions and systems were evolving at the time and how these sorts of changes really enabled technological advances being able to get into the hands of consumers.
Right, exactly. You can't have a sewing machine revolution and a clothing revolution if you don't have people able to buy any of those things. So in order to understand the second industrial revolution and the consumer economy that comes out of that, you have to understand the finance side as it related to individuals. Rachel, I'll go to you for your closing thoughts.
So last week kind of painted a picture of a United States that was working on a very, very different level financially. But this week, I think you're really seeing the foundation for today's consumer economy and the way consumers use credit and money to acquire goods that maybe aren't available to them without these financial instruments. So it's shaping a world that is becoming more and more recognizable to the modern person.
Absolutely. And that is, of course, why we've been doing so many of these Second Industrial Revolution episodes. And when we do the First Industrial Revolution episodes, it's usually to explain a foundational point of how they got to the Second Industrial Revolution. But I absolutely agree with you. This is a prime example of something where, yeah, it's not exactly the same as what we have today or even 50 years ago, but you can see exactly where it's going to go. You can see those very clear foundations and roots there. It's recognizable as being the same system at a less advanced stage in a way that is not as true for the first industrial revolution, the antebellum period. All right, well, thank you both so much for being on the show this week. And again, we hope folks will stick around for the upcoming parts of this series. ArsenalForDemocracy.com, as always, for the notes on this week. Thanks for listening.